It is as if a heavy, impenetrable fog covering my consciousness were now beginning to roll back and give me a clear view. I survey my whole life, my situation among people who treated me as if I were half animal, without love, without pity. In my semi-conscious state, I put up with everything, their many blows, their heartlessness, their ridicule as they, the people on the farm, made fun of my imperfections and my helplessness. How could I have thought about the way my hands looked, or about my appearance in general? When I was young, I sometimes wanted to be pretty to please him. In those days I tied colored ribbons in my hair, but after I lost him and the baby, I didn't care about anything anymore. I never thought again at all about looking in a mirror, and didn't care how my hands looked. I only cared what people put in my outstretched, begging hands. Yes, now I can suddenly remember clearly that many people, as they were reaching over to put a coin in my hand, and I was grasping it eagerly, quickly drew back their hand from mine and let the money fall in order not to touch my fingers. Now I understand. Now I am disgusted too when I look at my decrepit hands. When I look at my dirty, torn, stinking beggar's rags. I wonder what my face looks like. Oh, if only he had not abandoned me so cruelly, neither of us would now be in this terrible state of neglect, and I would not have lost the child. Why? Why did it all have to happen? And why must we meet again in this way? Our lives are over. There is no way we can make amends. It's all over. Too late. Too late. Unspeakable hopelessness comes over me and I plunge into absolute despair. A terrible pain cuts through my whole being. I feel my heart is breaking. A cramp holds my heart as in a vice. Then everything blacks out before me. Everything disappears. I fall into an abyss of nothingness. Someone is groaning, rasping and gasping. I hear it and want to see who it is. Slowly it gets light around me, and then my glance comes to rest on my husband's terrified face. Suddenly I realize that I am the one who is struggling to breathe. I am sitting up in bed, and he is shaking me desperately. When he sees that I recognize him, he breathes a sigh of relief and asks in a half-terrified voice, "What's the matter with you? Are you all right again? I was frightened stiff. I woke up because of your groaning. You were sitting up in bed with your eyes wide open, but you didn't recognize me. You were looking right through me, right off into space. Didn't even see me. What's the matter with you? For heaven's sake, tell me what's the matter." I look at him, open my mouth to reply, but cannot bring forth a single sound. My throat is still clamped shut out of sheer horror. Little by little I recover my senses enough to form words he can hear and understand. "Not now, I cannot speak now, tomorrow." My husband stops asking questions, and I fall back on my pillows. He holds my hand in his as he observes me carefully. Then, seeing I have calmed down again, he puts out the light. The next morning as we sat together in the garden, I told him my vision of the previous night. I was a beggar woman who remembered her whole life, and I am, or was once, this beggar woman. I remember everything clearly that I once experienced when I was this woman. It was my own life which suddenly awakened to consciousness. I was an abandoned servant girl, I went on telling my husband, living on a large country estate. I had no father, and had no memory of ever having had either father or mother. Among the many people around me as I grew up, there was a coachman who took care of the horses, meant servants who cut wood and fed the hunting dogs, the cook who worked in the big kitchen and many other girls working in the kitchen, the courtyard and the house. This is where I have grown up, and this is all I know as home. Ever since I can remember, people have been pushing me around, and I have had to work at whatever jobs they gave me to do. After I grew up, I also had to help in the big house where our master and his family lived. It was a huge house with many rooms, and I learned from the chambermaids that the rooms and their furnishings were all very beautiful. I was never allowed to enter them because I had no shoes, and only servants with shoes were allowed inside. I was an outside maid. All the rooms opened onto a very, Very long corridor, and it was my job to keep this corridor clean. I carried over huge buckets of water from the well. Then, kneeling down, I scrubbed the big colored tiles with a brush. I still see these tiles quite close to my face as I bend over them and rub, 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 move back a row and then rub some more. Now and again I pour out water onto the floor and go on rubbing, row by row. Endlessly. And when I finally do finish, I have to wash the corridor on the floor above. Days go by. Months and years, and I go on washing and scrubbing these same stone floors. I am contented and seldom think about anything beyond the work I have to do. I like to wash these tile floors. They're colorful, and I like colorful things. In return for my work, I can eat in the kitchen and sleep in a little room over the stable behind the house. In the courtyard, I often see carriages which do not belong to our master. They belong to his guests who have already alighted at the front door. The coachmen drive their carriages into the courtyard, unhitch the horses, walk them around in a circle until they are cooled off, then lead them into the stable for the night. Many guests come for hunting, and then my corridors are full of mud. The many men walk around with muddy boots, and I have to get up at the crack of dawn to wash my corridors so they will be clean when my master and his guests get up. One day when I happen to be in the courtyard, a wonderfully handsome young man comes out of the house, crosses the courtyard and enters the stable to look after his horse. He has his horse saddled, mounts and rides away. As if struck by magic, I look up at him. He is so marvelously handsome, and once he even looks around at me. I idolize him as if he were a god, and later during that very same night when he visits me in my little room, I allow him with joyous abandon to do with me whatever he wishes. His face shines through the mists which obscure my mind. For long and rapturous minutes I am in his arms. As he often came for hunting, my life was made up of happy days when he was there and long days of waiting for him to return. In a year's time our baby came. The cook helped me when I sought assistance and collapsed in front of her door. I did not know what was happening. But after I had endured terrible suffering and they laid the baby in my arms, I felt warmth in my heart for it. For the first time in my life I was really happy. Somebody needed me, for somebody I meant everything. The cook spoke with her mistress, who came, looked at me and the child, and gave her consent for the child to remain with me. I will work, I promised, harder than ever before, if only I can keep my child. When he, the father of my child, came back to our house again for a visit and came up to my little room to see me again, as was his custom, I proudly showed him the child and asked him to allow me to work in his house, on his estate, so that I could serve him. At first he shrank back horrified and then went on to say it was not at all sure that he was the father. Who knows, he said, what servant around here may be the father? In vain I tried to explain to him that no man had ever touched me, that I had defended myself like a wild animal, and that I had allowed only him to do as he wished with me. In vain I pleaded with him to allow me to work in his vicinity, promising not to molest or disturb him if only I could be near him. For a while he listened. Then as I knelt before him, my arms around his knees, he pushed me away and ran out into the night. I never saw him again. Whether or not he ever came back to the house, I do not know. In any case, he never entered our courtyard again. In vain I waited year after year. He disappeared out of my life. But the baby was there. It meant everything to me. It filled my every waking thought. It meant more to me than life itself. I scrubbed the colored tiles in the corridor and thought of my baby. I drew water from the well and thought of my baby. I hurried through my work even harder and faster, so that I could be with the child. It was a girl, pretty and intelligent like her father. She always did the opposite of what I told her, brooking no opposition. The more I became her slave, the less loving she was to me. When she was still quite small, she was rude and disrespectful towards me. Nothing I said or did pleased her, and what she liked best was to leave me and run around the countryside alone. Sometimes she went so far that she came back only the next day. I was in desperation and, when work was over, went out into the night to try to find her. When she came back the next day, the light came back into my life and everything was all right again. One day my child left me and did not come back. I waited in desperation, searched throughout the surrounding region, waited and hunted, but to no avail, my daughter was gone. The sun went out of my life, my world was suddenly empty, I had nothing more to live for and was absolutely unable to work. After a time I could bear it no longer and went away to search for my child. I never returned. I traveled from town to town and village to village asking people whether they had seen my child. Years went by, and I was still searching. Searching without hope, going on and on out of pure habit, driven by inner unrest. People gave me food to eat, and as my clothes began to wear thin and get torn, they would give me old worn-out odds and ends of clothing. I kept on going from place to place, on and on. Once in my wanderings I met the cook I had worked with on the country estate. In the meantime she had married and was living with her husband in this city where I met her. She took me home, gave me some supper and told me that the father of my child. Here my husband suddenly seized my hand and interrupted my story. White as a sheet and with trembling voice, he said, "Wait, wait. I'll go on with the story. I know what happened. I remember what happened then. While you were talking, everything suddenly became clear to me. I recognized myself and I know I was this man who abandoned you. I know I was terribly frivolous then and lacking in responsibility. I lived only to amuse myself and threw my money around with both hands until the day came when I lost everything. My family property was auctioned off, and I was obliged to leave my land and my manor. At first I turned to the friends who had spent time drinking and gambling with me and otherwise helping me squander my inheritance. But after a few weeks they made it obvious that my presence in their homes was superfluous. This experience was repeated with other so-called friends until I was completely disgusted at myself and at them. About that time, a real friend advised me to go to work. I wanted to make a fresh start and sincerely tried to get work, but nobody took me and my search for work seriously. I did not know how to work, or what I should do. And so I sank lower and lower. Finally I got a fixed idea that my tragic lot was God's punishment for having so despicably abandoned you and our child. I went to see my friend in whose home you had worked. I had no mission other than to find out what had happened to you both, but when I came you were gone, and no one knew where. As time went on, I found fewer and fewer friends willing to lend me money. When the time came that none of my erstwhile friends would take me in and give me a loan and as I was getting on in years, I began to ask complete strangers for help. So little by little I became a beggar, roaming the country, traveling from place to place, and spending the night wherever good-hearted people would allow me to sleep in their barn or stable. Physically as well as financially I fell further and further into ruin. With hunger plaguing me more and more as I got on in years, I finally reached the point where I had no pride or self-respect anymore at all and began to beg publicly on busy street corners. Thus it came about that we finally met as beggars. I listened eagerly to everything he told me, for it was exactly as I knew it to be. I knew from the very beginning that my husband was the old beggar, and I was amazed that he too remembered this previous existence in as much detail as I. The events he recalled tallied exactly with what the cook told me when I visited her, namely that he had squandered his inheritance and estate, and that one time, much later, he had come by the manor where I had worked in the hope of finding me. There was nothing left of the dashing young cavalier he had once been. Through sheer neglect and lack of honest effort, he had already become a human derelict, roaming the countryside and looking for handouts. After I had met the cook, I went back to our old manor to ask whether anyone knew his address. But there was no one who knew where he had gone or where he could be found. As I got on in years, I found it harder and harder to travel. Finally, I settled in the city and made my living by begging near the stairs. It was there we finally met again and there I passed my last hours. For when I recognized him and realized that my whole life had been wasted and that there was no way of making amends because it was too late. Too late. Our child was lost and my life was over. I died right there sitting on the cornerstone. My memories stopped there. For a long time we looked at each other speechless, scarcely believing that such a thing could happen to two intelligent people in this modern world. What we had just experienced cannot be explained by any of the current theories of heredity or psychology. We knew that everything had really and truly happened just that way. There was no imagination involved. The experience of having remembered this earlier meeting shook us both to the depths of our being. For a long time we sat beside each other in complete silence, while our thoughts spun around in circles. Finally my husband said, "I never before wondered why, since my early youth, I have strictly avoided drinking, cards and other games of chance, dancing and all other forms of social life. This despite the fact that it is very much in my nature to enjoy drinking, dancing and entertainment. Now I realize how, after squandering my inheritance in riotous living and being obliged to live in abject misery, the idea was hammered home deeper and deeper into my consciousness that I must never again drink, never again gamble, never again be careless and happy-go-lucky. Since then I have learned to recognize the value of money. And I have come to realize that the worth of a human being begins when he is able to make a living for himself and his family. All of these views now lie anchored deep in my subconscious because of what I learned and came to realize in that incarnation. That's why, in my present life, I was so anxious to study, just study throughout all the years of my youth. The subconscious knowledge and recognition of these facts was what gave me strength to resist and say no when the boys I went to college with set out to amuse themselves. I was always afraid that something terrible would happen to me if I allowed myself to get caught up in their parties and social life. Now I realize that I was only afraid of the misery which resulted from my devil-may-care way of living in that previous existence. My profound antipathy towards drinking and gambling and my realization that I must never indulge in such a way of life were rooted deep down in my subconscious. "Yes," I replied, "and after having been completely idle in that life, you are now diligent to a fault, thinking only of your work." "That's right. In the second half of that existence of mine I wanted to work but I hadn't learned a trade and didn't know what work meant. When I asked for work, people refused to take me seriously. Wouldn't even trust me to do a job. Later during my vagabond years, strangers took pity on me and gave me work, cutting wood, loading carts, gathering grapes, beating carpets, and while I did these menial tasks with unskilled hands unused to work, I began to feel the great and overpowering desire to learn something useful. To be rich in skill and knowledge. And so in this life I have learned everything I possibly could, and I intend to continue learning until the end of my days." When he spoke the words "till the end of my days" I felt as if an iron hand were contracting about my heart. Where will my child and I be at the end of his days? I became stiff with fear. It is a law of nature. When we strike our hand against a wall, the wall strikes back without intending to. It isn't the wall which really strikes back, but our own blow bounces back. In any case, whatever we hit always gives back the same blow we gave it. No, I don't want to think through this premonition clear to the end. We will not leave him, no, no, no. Then I thought about the relationship between my past life and my present one. What was the reason for this weakness of mine, for my having lived in this mental fog? And why, without any transition, was I now blessed with talents and skills? I could find no explanation. For days we were under the impression of this tremendous experience, but soon we found ourselves going swimming and boating with our neighbor friends, so our memories from a previous existence soon began to pale. We were both of us much too business-like to bother our heads about the long-distant past. My husband was soon obliged to leave anyway as his holidays were over. I stayed on with the other members of my family and their children. The entire region of the Great Lake was of volcanic origin, and the local radiations probably affected me so greatly that I often had visions there. I am inclined by nature to be very matter-of-fact, and always try to find a natural reason for everything I experience. I was never inclined to believe in ghosts or demons, and when people told me stories about nocturnal manifestations or appearances that were supposed to be almost nightly events in one old castle or another, I just smiled condescendingly in the manner of the inexperienced, thinking to myself that these persons were letting their imagination run away with them. The very last thing I would have imagined is that I myself would have such experiences. Moreover, it is characteristic of visions that one never succeeds in having them through an act of will. On the other hand, they can come quite suddenly and unexpectedly when one's mind is fully occupied with other things. That very same summer after my husband had returned to his work in the city, we were all retiring to rest after a happy day. I entered my room where my little son was already fast asleep. I lay down, extinguished the candle. In this remote place there was no electricity, and went to sleep. I do not know how long I had been sleeping when I suddenly awoke, aware of a noise in the room. It sounded as if someone were groping around in the darkness. I reached for the box of matches, quickly lit my candle, and a moment later was lunging towards a horrible apparition which was already carrying my child in its arm and trying to escape. It was a female form, similar to pictures one sees of witches, and when I surprised her with my light, she was trying to glide out of the room on a cord or wire which led from our beds, through the window. I lunged at her, seized my child and tried to take it away from her. She hung on tight, and a terrible struggle began. The witch had already moved up a bit on the wire. It seemed almost as if in some way or other she were connected to it, as if there were a flow of force from it to give her strength. But she could not get away because I clung desperately to my child. Each of us was holding my boy's body in a grip of steel, pulling him to and fro as we struggled. Somehow I felt intuitively that she could only hold on to my child for a short time, and if she could not succeed in wrenching him from me within this short time, she would have to fly away empty-handed. So this violent struggle continued until suddenly and quite unexpectedly she relinquished the child, glided out of the window on the wire, and disappeared in the darkness. And I? I was kneeling in my bed, my son was lying beside me, resting in absolute peace, snugly covered, and sound asleep. But the candle was burning on my night table. Had I been dreaming? Had I forgotten to extinguish the candle before falling asleep? No, the match was still glowing beside it, proving that I had only just lit the candle. The entire scene must have taken place within the space of a few moments. If it were not so, the match would not have been still warm. No, I had not been dreaming. I extinguished the candle, lay back in bed, and tried to quiet my galloping heartbeat. What was that? A witch? Are there such things? What is a witch? Why do painters everywhere always paint the same kind of witches, and where does this figure come from? How does it come about that there are such things as witches in the first place, and why do people claim that witches ride on broomsticks? If witches are really only a figment of the imagination, why do drawings and sketches of them look just about the same the world over, showing them with long, pointed, drooping noses, hunched backs, and broomsticks in their hands? Why isn't a witch ever shown with a club foot? Because people say the devil has a club foot. But how do they know for sure that the devil has a club foot and a witch does not? Who has ever seen a devil and a witch? Now I have some idea about why witches are drawn with broomsticks in their hands. The witch I had seen was holding onto this wire, and when she flew out of the window on it, I could easily have imagined her to be riding on a broomstick. I can understand that uneducated villagers who know nothing about currents of force think a witch is holding onto a broomstick and flying away on it. The witch was the personified servant of the evil one. I simply knew it. She was reality, a fact. Had the whole scene been merely a projection, an illusion? Naturally, I knew it had been. But what caused it? Where did it come from? And why just such a picture? For me, that was reality, and the interesting question was why everyone who sees such an illusion, or projection, or whatever we may choose to call it, sees it in the same form. Why do we all carry this picture in our subconscious, if it really does come from our subconscious? It could, of course, be answered that I had seen pictures of witches and this was a projection of pictures I had seen. But such was not the case. For even though the witch was very similar to the usual pictures one sees, I noticed to my great surprise that her appearance did not coincide with them in all details. And where did this strange wire or rope come from? I had never seen such a thing in any of the pictures, and yet it was there. Moreover, after my experiments in the transmission of wool from one person to another, I had quite a different opinion about this wire. I could understand it in terms of a flow of force, perhaps even a flow of will. But where did it come from? And from whom? And if a flow of force can be seen as a physical form, is not the witch herself perhaps merely a form built up of forces radiating from a source or from different sources? And what are we human beings? Where does the human form come from? Are we not also visible forms made up of various flows of force? What is reality? Only what can be touched and grasped? Are not we human beings, too, merely projections? And do we not merely believe that we are actually formed? Are not love, hate, hope, desperation, good and evil realities too? Do not people suffer or rejoice because of these intangible, invisible forces which are not any less actual than the tangible realities? Naturally, I know the physical form of my child, the real child, as people would say, was lying peacefully in bed during my struggle with the apparition. And I am equally convinced that the entire struggle occurred only between forces and not between bodies. But does that make this struggle any less real? Was not perhaps the apparition of the witch and the child even much more real than the child's material form lying in bed? What is a material form? Only the resultant outward cover of forces which build up the material body. Hence the force is the cause, the material body only the effect. Which is more important and the more real? For a long time I went on asking myself these and similar questions about the experiences I had had. For me it was perfectly real. I had enough proof that I had not fallen asleep. And even had this been the case, it is perfectly possible to experience complete reality in a dream. Several nights later, after all the family had gone to bed, and the house had quieted down for the night, I too went to bed. It had been an exceptionally hot day, and my room was close and sultry, so I not only left my window open, but also the door from my room into the hall outside. Thus from my bed I could see the staircase leading up to the rooms above. As I lay there, I reviewed the whole day in my mind. What had I done well? What not so well? What should I have said or done, and what should I not have said or done? Then I went over in my mind what I wanted to cook the next day, for the housekeeping was my task. Thus my thoughts were occupied with quite everyday, matter-of-fact things. Suddenly I noticed that two peculiar forms were approaching from the house door, trying slowly and stealthily to cross in front of mine. They were both full-size human forms, absolutely black like shadows. I did not see them as three-dimensional figures. Instead, I had the impression that the only reason I could see them at all was because they were absorbing all the light in the place they happened to be. To express the matter in different terms, I did not really see these beings themselves but the hole they made in the rays of light where they were. In scientific terms, they were causing complete interference with the light rays, and I could only be aware of their presence by virtue of the fact that there were no light rays at all where these two beings stood. Otherwise, they were invisible. It is difficult to find an expression adequate to describe this phenomenon. In a twinkling, I understood why farmers use the word shadow in talking about ghosts or spooky apparitions. Actually, these two figures were shadows, but not shadows made by anything else. On the contrary, They were shadows solely because of the complete absence of light. I had never dreamed that there could be such complete blackness. Later it occurred to me that the astronomers know of such a black hole in the skies. Caused by a complete absence of light, it is known as the horse's head because of its peculiar shape.